Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:41 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is Friday, and it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes on September 7th. Well, I thought I would kick off today by looking at wage growth in the USA, because it broke out of what has been a range now for the last 2.5 years. There's been quite a bit of volatility in that range, where we've seen rather extreme peak-to-trough swings, but there has been a clear upward bias to wage growth over the course of the last 12 months, and it's at a new recovery high, almost up towards 3%. Well, there has been this argument going on about where we can anticipate, or when, I think, would be the question of... when is it that we're going to see inflationary pressure start to re-emerge, that we've had this transition from massive monetary stimulus to fiscal stimulus? If we look at the Fed's balance sheet, it is definitely contracting, and it looks, and sorry about that, I'm not typing very well. If we look at it just on a yearly basis, we can see that the rate has contracted from over 4.45 to 4.2 trillion over the course of the last 12 months. But there is a clear downward bias now to this very long-term chart. In fact, this contraction is even larger than that which we saw at the end of 2008. And that's the only time we've seen prior to this, the USA reducing the size of its balance sheet. So the Fed is reducing the size of its balance sheet, but the size of the fiscal stimulus, the size of this incredible round of stimulus that we've had from the fact that taxes have been cut, that money is pouring back into the country from overseas, that then you have the earnings boost because of a buoyant consumer sector. All of that has helped to stoke the economy so that U.S. Growth is outperforming just about everywhere else. And that's leading to this exceptionalism where you've had Wall Street outperforming just about everywhere else for a while. But that doesn't negate the fact that we are relatively late in the cycle. So let's have a look at exactly where that is. And this graphic from Moody's I saw today, I thought was really quite instructive, because it shows us the economic growth cycle, the monetary policy cycle, and the credit cycle. Well, what is also worth highlighting here is that it is the credit cycle tends to lead everything else. So the credit cycle for the U.S. is in about halfway through the mature stage. The UK is even further along on that metric. But when we look at it in terms of the monetary cycle and the economic cycle, well, they're still in the late credit cycle. So what we can definitely see is that when we think about credit contraction, that's where the Fed is going, and the size of the Fed's balance sheet is pointing us in that direction. So this is about where, if you're going to anticipate that you're going to have a type 1 acceleration, that it's about where we would anticipate that happening, because it's late in the cycle. Interest rates have not got prohibitively high, and growth is strong, so therefore this is where people tend to get very enthusiastic. There's two ways they get enthusiastic. Those that have been long for a while start to leverage up. Those that have not been long, they feel under enormous pressure to buy in. And that succession of new money coming into the market is what's helping to propel these the market higher. Then, of course, you have the point that you have a record supply of buybacks coming in. So that, in fact, is withdrawing supply from the market. And the size of the stock market is contracting because so many shares have been bought back. There are companies that are being taken over and therefore going private, which is reducing the issuance of shares. That is overwhelming the supply of new shares that are coming into the market as a result of IPOs. So the size of the overall stock market has been contracting for really quite a long time. That's a factor of interest rates. If, for example, we look at a company like Amazon, or let's for maybe even more important would be Apple. I mean, look at the weighted average cost of capital. That when Apple is issuing equity, it costs about just less than 10%. When they issue debt, it's about 2.5%. Their weighted average cost of capital, therefore, is 9%. Therefore, they would be much better off buying back their shares, which cost them 10%, and issuing debt to compensate for that at 2.5% and picking up the spread in between. And that is what has helped to propel the stock higher. They're buying back record quantities of their own shares. And certainly we saw a little bit of a pause coming in here today, but this is still a very rhythmically trending advance. The pace of the advance has definitely picked up over the course of the last month. If we're looking for a group to accelerate higher, then it is in these companies that have got lots of equity, little debt, and plenty of cash flow. What is interesting is that Amazon doesn't buy back its own shares at all, and that has not stopped the share from continuing to advance. Now, it has paused in here this week around the 2000 level, and when we look at it on a daily basis, we can see that it was due another pause in consolidation, and it does appear now to be getting that pause in consolidation. But the succession of ranges, one above another, continues to hold, and as long as it holds today's lows, well, then we can conclude that this is nothing more than just another really quite brief pause. Of course, when you look at something that is this overextended relative to the trend mean, we know what the risks are. The risk, of course, is that it could pull back by $400 and still be in the region of the trend mean. So there is absolutely risk here when we think about where the price was back in January, and it was also very overextended, that there was acute risk of a pullback, and therefore this is certainly not a risk-free environment when we look at some of these accelerating trends. And in the semiconductors sector, advanced micro devices took off in the last month, and it went from 15 in June to 30 this week. So now it is prone to consolidation. It's one of the better performers within the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, but this index has certainly lost momentum over the course of the last 6 months. It rebounded incredibly impressively off the low that we saw in January, but was not able to hold it. Now we've seen four failed breaks above 1400, and it is starting to come back down to test the region of the trend mean. Well, thought it was instructive today that it spent the vast majority of the day in positive territory and then gave up the entire advance in the last hour. Or the last couple of hours, and now is treading new lows. This has the characteristics, if we think about what it is that a type 2 top looks like. Well, generally speaking, it's a broadening pattern that you get a trend that was previously consistent, then moves into a much bigger and more lengthy range, but that the progression of higher reaction lows remains intact. So people are not seeing any profit erosion. Then you start to see failed upside breaks, which tells us that there is a surfeit of supply above the market. And when people are bored, when they see they may not have experienced profit erosion, but they're not seeing their portfolio increasing any longer, well, they get bored. And they start to get a little bit antsy about holding on to the profits that they have, so they start raising their stops. And the place where most people put their stops is below the most recent low. Well, the most recent low is at about $1,320, and the price of the index is about 1,360 right now. So There's about 40 points, and it's not $1,320, but there's about 40 points where it still has room in which to consolidate, but then we're going to be getting down to where there's a good chance there's a considerable number of stops. So this is, I think, an index that is really worth monitoring, considering just how well it did between 2016 and the beginning of this year. When we look at the Nasdaq itself, then it has been doing really very well, and it did break out and succeeded in extending its breakout following the peak in January and March. But now it was down in here this week in a somewhat dynamic manner. But the progression of higher reaction lows remains intact. This is about where, if support is going to be found and this rather impressive advance since early April is going to be sustained, that we would anticipate supply starting to come back, or excuse me, demand coming back to dominance. So it's a rather interesting time because we've seen already that there has been evidence of acceleration. We may yet see more acceleration, but we are in the latter stages of this bull market. There is, I think, when we think about the fact that you've had fiscal stimulus has taken over from monetary stimulus, well, fiscal stimulus does not last indefinitely. The quantity of money that has been brought back from overseas will also not last forever. And I think something that did catch my attention in here this week, and we find the graphic. I've opened lots of them since before I started the broadcast. It's this difference between the U.S. ISM manufacturing new orders and China's Guangdong manufacturing new orders. They're going in opposite directions. Well, China exports a lot more to Europe than it does to the USA. And I think that's rather interesting. This is something that may be a factor in the underperformance that we're seeing in Europe right now. I've been talking for most of this year about the additional risk premium that China should command as a result of the fact that you've had deteriorating standards of governance and now you have an authoritarian regime that is totalitarian in nature. Almost, I think there's a good argument that it's more like a fascist regime and it has increasing eyes on global dominion. And that is certainly one of the factors that has been really weighing on the stock market there over this year. This is not a consistent trend if we look at it over the last decade. We had this incredible spike higher in 2014 and 2015, and the price is now back at the lows we saw in the region of the beginning of 2016. Well, if we zoom in and look at the daily chart, it has paused around this 2800 point level, and this is a potential area of support, but the rally so far has been pretty modest. And there is I think, the rather important point that China is weighing on its financial sector. The imbalances and the excesses that have driven the market over the course of the last few decades are being reined in, and that is most particularly deleterious for the banking sector, that they don't have access to the kind of profit potential that they might once have had. And then you have the fact that the property developers had more or less a license to print money over the course of the last 40 years because they were getting free land. There was no property taxes. They were getting subsidized in terms of their building materials. They had very low wages. And then the property price did nothing but go up. Well, all of that was based on leverage. There was this hand-in-hand nature of a relationship between local government and the property developers because the only way that regional governments can boost their returns when you don't have property taxes is that they were selling land. Well, that then creates a symbiotic relationship between government and property. And there is an incentive to issue as much credit to property developers as possible. Well, China never had defaults either, and now it does. And that's a big uncertainty. We simply do not know what the natural rate of default is in China. And I suspect that it's not until we do know what that is that we can't really have confidence in any kind of rebound. The Shanghai Property Index is barely steady, and this does not look like a consolidation. It looks like a distribution in an evolving downtrend. So that, I think, brings us to the point about the renminbi. The vast majority of headlines that we've seen over the course of the last few months have been about Turkey, and they've been about Argentina and Venezuela. But those were known problems. I don't think that there is, it's certainly not in the price right now that the renminbi is going to weaken through 7. We saw some intervention by the People's Bank of China 4 weeks ago, and that resulted in what I think is probably a one-hit wonder in terms of the appreciation of the currency. Since then, the renminbi has been stubbornly holding around 6.8 to the dollar. Now, the Chinese administration is weighing in, and they're trying to make it more expensive for people to short the currency. But what that does not do is stop people from simply selling it. That if they're holding renminbi, that they can move it or that they can change it into another currency. And that is one of the primary facts. One of the most important considerations from China's perspective is capital flight. So that's the reason why they went in to support the currency at 6.9. That will be the reason why they support the currency in future interventions. But at the same time, the renminbi has been a policy tool for the administration, not just recently, but for decades. I think it is worth just looking at the very long-term chart, because between 1981 and the devaluation ahead of the Asian financial crisis in 1994, the renminbi went from about 1.5 to the dollar to almost 9. And it was during a property crash, and it was during a real massive required recapitalization of the banking sector that this massive devaluation occurred. Well, the banks don't look strong, most particularly the regional banks. And it's difficult to monitor those regional banks because they're not listed. What I think is worth keeping an eye on, though, is Cinda Asset Management, because that is one of the original bad banks that was set up after the last property crisis, which is basically 25 years ago, and it is pushing on to new lows. So this again does not look like a bullish chart. What's also, I think, worthy of consideration is that it's getting kind of dangerous to be a billionaire in China. You had Wang Jian, who fell from his death in France in August. You had the CEO of JD.com, who was accused of rape just last week in Minnesota. And today you had Jack Ma saying that he's retiring from Alibaba. Well, if we look at some of these companies, Tencent has certainly had its wings clipped, where when the Chinese administration said that they are banning all new games in an effort to protect the eyesight of Chinese children, and Tencent has now been falling for just about all of this year, and it was at a new reaction low in here today. Alibaba has been ranging for much of the last few months, and it broke downwards yesterday. It was just about steady in here today, but the 200-day moving average is starting to roll over it, and it really would need to rally back above $180 to even begin to question that this isn't top formation completion territory. Then when we look at, for example, Geely Automotive, which was one of the best performing shares ahead of this year, well, it's had a bit of volatility over the last few days, but this has been a rather crushing decline. One of the best performing sectors in China has been education. And when we look at TAL Education Group, for example, having been an incredible high flyer, it has now given up a substantial proportion of that advance. Again, the consistency of the trend has been broken. And that downside key reversal at the top was incredibly dynamic. Well, the only other share that's had that kind of downward dynamic in the last while is Facebook. That was an enormous downside key reversal that we saw at in the middle of this year. Now, I think it's arguable that it was self-inflicted, but there were a lot of people who got stopped out, and they have not subsequently bought back in because the share is at new reaction lows in here today. And it has encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. Well, personally, I think that the most likely scenario is that Facebook is going to range, but we haven't yet seen evidence that the low is in. And if we start to see the price coming below $150, well, then it will have broken the progression of higher major reaction lows. And then we're going to be in a much more difficult environment. One would have to question what the point is in holding it at that stage. So this is, a rather key level for Facebook, and indeed for a number of the other social media companies. Twitter, for example, is back down to $30, and it's below the trend mean. And again, this is at the risk of being policed. Well, when we look at what exactly is going on, there is the attempt so far to police their platforms has been to deplatform a significant number of what might be considered polemics or people that make sensational remarks. And that really does have a whiff of censorship. So when you have such enormously powerful social media companies, obviously it is not their duty to offer a platform to everyone who wants to speak, but the way in which they are curtailing free speech for only certain segments is something that is potentially even worse from a political perspective for them than the fact that they enabled meddling in elections. So this is a rather interesting environment for these companies, and selling pressure has not yet abated. Then when we look at Google, well, the price is now back below $1,200. So the repair of the consistency of the trend that had been underway is now being questioned. The big question now is whether the region of the trend mean is going to hold. That much larger reaction that we saw at the beginning of this year was an inconsistency. And it is not unusual that previously very consistent trends become inconsistent at their penultimate highs. So these are, I think, rather important developments that we're seeing. There are certain shares that are accelerating higher, then there are others that had been trending rather consistently have begun to lose consistency. So what is doing well in this particular environment? Well, people are starting to look back at defensive type shares, and at the consumer staples sector was bouncing this week from the region of its trend mean. And that was after a really quite large pullback that we saw at the beginning of the year, which really did question the consistency of the trend. Well, when people start to look for defensives, they start to look for things that have got reliable yields, and the utility sector has also bounced pretty impressively. But the big question then is, what are people thinking about the government bond markets? because treasuries have bounced from the region of the lower side of its range. It's been ranging between 2.8 and 3% for most of this year, and the argument for why yields should be going higher or moving lower have been in relative equilibrium. The oversold condition relative to the trend mean has been almost unwound. And the argument for why yields should be going higher is because inflationary pressures are starting to rise, and with wage growth starting to pick up, well, that's an important consideration on that front. Then, on the other side of that, you have the fact that you have such an enormous amount of trouble in the emerging markets as a result of the dollar's strength and their deteriorating standards of governance, and that is creating a bid for US-denominated assets, which is beneficial to US Treasury markets. Now, those two arguments have been relatively counterbalanced for the last 8 months. But with wage growth starting to pick up and break out, then the argument for why inflation is likely to rear its head once more, I think, is becoming more powerful. And one of the reasons that I'm willing to reach that conclusion is because of TIPS yields. There is no new issuance of TIPS planned this year. And the yield is now coming back up towards the upper side of its range. It has bounced from the region of the trend mean, and there has been a clear upward bias to that trend since the middle of 2016, so it's coming to the upper side of that range. The two-year yield has broken out as well. It's at new highs in here today. I think that's pricing in the potential for continued rate hikes, not just for this year, but into next year as well. If we look at that on a longer term basis, then we can see that there has been a progression of lower rally highs. And the most recent one of those lower highs was around the 5% level. One of the big questions, and it's a theory that has been circulating the markets, is that the next time we see a peak in the yield will be somewhere around 3.5%, because that's where the economists are starting to think that interest rate hikes will start to have an effect on the stock market. But considering the fact that the yield went almost to zero in the last loosening cycle, well, we would have to then question whether the 3.5% estimate is correct, or whether this downtrend is going to be broken, or whether in the event that we get into another loosening cycle of quantitative easing, that the USA doesn't go for negative interest rates, and we could see yields going negative, just like we have seen in Germany. So these are the potential outcomes from the next recession. And if we think back to that credit cycle, well, we know we're in the latter stages of this expansion. But we're not at the end of it. And the high yield spreads have been ranging for a year and a half already, and they continue to range. The breakout that we saw in the summer was not sustained, and it is now back inside the range and approximating the region of the trend mean. Well, high yield spreads are contained, certainly, but some of the biggest issuers of debt in the high yield sector are also some of the big technology companies, and Tesla was down in a dynamic manner in here this week. It is right back in the lows that we saw earlier this year. $250 is about where, if it's going to bounce, then this is about where it should start to happen. But we've seen some very dynamic moves inside this range, and the most recent dynamic is on the downside. And I think we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. I have talked about Tesla being the canary in the coal mine for the high yield sector. And the reason for that is that in an environment where you have lots and lots of additional capital flooding the market, The companies that tend to do best are those that are the most risk tolerant, those that go out and seek risk and borrow as much as they can, betting that they can get to a revenue positive position before the loans get called back in. Well, Tesla is really skirting the edge of what is possible, and they are just about hitting their targets, but the fact is that their CEO has been incredibly volatile, and that is acting as a deleterious factor on the share price right now. The other company that borrowed left and right to boost its market was Netflix. Well, Netflix bounced very impressively 3 weeks ago from the region of the trend mean, and it was in negative territory in here today. Well, there is absolutely no doubting that it accelerated in the early part of this year, and in fact, I think it's the best performing share on the S&P 500 this year, even after the pullback. But that kind of acceleration from a previously well-established bull market is a trend-ending signal. Then we've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. At the minimum, we're going to see some ranging. And if the region of the trend mean is broken, well, then we're talking about a top formation completion. Well, high yield spreads have been very inert for really quite a long time. And if we start to see issuers like Netflix and Tesla declining, well, that is going to start having an effect. The potential for interest rates to continue to rise is increasing the cost of capital for the high yield issuers. Even if the spread isn't widening, the absolute rate that they're paying for new debt is increasing. And that is going to contribute to a somewhat higher default rate, but perhaps not right away. When we still have the US economy expanding and wages in an upward trend, where government bond yields are not surging higher and stock market investors have not really experienced a great deal of profit erosion, then you have the other things that we look at. So we have the yield curve spread, which has in fact been expanding over the last couple of weeks. Well, every time it becomes negative, it's a lead indicator for a recession for anything from 6 to 18 months out. And right now it's at 23 basis points. It was at 19 basis points a couple of weeks ago. But it's really not until it becomes negative that we get a lead indicator. Then we have the unemployment rate, which continues to move lower. Well, if we look at the trend in unemployment, it's very consistent. And it's hard to imagine that you're going to have a recession as long until the unemployment rate turns around. So we're back close to record low unemployment levels, below 4%. This has been about as employed as the US economy gets. And the participation rate has, well, I haven't actually looked at the participation rate before I started this broadcast, so I think I should perhaps put the chart up before I comment on it. But participation is static when we look at this chart. So what that also means is that the people who could come back into the labor force have not yet done so in large numbers, and that is a factor in helping to drive the wage rate higher. So there is potential for, if more people enter the labor force, then that will moderate the pace with which the unemployment rate is starting to come down. But it's really not until we start to see people losing their jobs that we would have evidence that a recession is in the offing. And there's just no evidence of that right now. Then we have oil prices. And maybe Brent crude is probably the best one to keep an eye on. Well, Brent got all the way up to $80 this week, and then it failed. It was in mildly positive territory in here today. But it's not really until you see that oil prices are surging higher that we would have a potential for it to represent a headwind to growth. If we started to see prices surging above 80 and moving to 120, like we saw at the end of 2010, well, that would represent a headwind. But most particularly a headwind for Europe and for the other major consuming nations. The USA is now a almost I guess a neutral participant, and there are certain segments of the economy would benefit from the higher oil price, although it would certainly weigh on the consumer. Therefore, if we look at the risk in China, the greatest risk is, I think, outstanding then, is in Europe. The European stock markets are coming back down towards the lower side of their respective ranges. The DAX index is right in the region of 12,000. It was just about steady in here today. This was a clear downward dynamic this week. It really does need to bounce from around this area to confirm support at the lower side of the 18-month range. If it fails here, well, we're at least moving into a more volatile period like we saw in 2015 and 2016. There is this simple matter of the fact that the ECB is exiting its quantitative easing program this month. So their balance sheet is not going to rise more than 4.6 trillion euro. And if it simply remains static, that means there's no new money coming into the market other than through the expiring bonds being reinvested. Well, that's a particularly thorny issue for Italy. Italian government bond yields continue to hold around this 3% level. I think there's a strong argument for why the nation's sovereign debt should be downgraded. And what it also is highlighting is that once the populist governments get into power within the Eurozone, they have in large part got their hands tied because of the straitjacket of the euro. It is really only when you have control of your own currency that you can dictate terms, because the currency can be devalued to such an extent that paying back the debt becomes less of an issue when it's been issued in local currency. Without that pressure release valve, then Italy is confined to doing exactly what the EU tells it to do. Eventually, people are going to come around to the notion that that's not such a great idea, and that the imbalances that exist within the Eurozone are simply not going to go away on their own. And the internal reweighting of economic fortunes that is required to balance out these different trade trends is incredibly painful on the domestic population. If we had to really think about some of the reasons why you have this revolt against the status quo, which has manifested itself in the USA and in the UK, in Italy and in Germany, Hungary and Poland. We have an election in Sweden this week, in India and the Philippines. Well, all of these are representative of a revolt against the status quo. What I find particularly interesting is that this rise of centrism and the complete absence of an alternative form of government has prevailed for much of the last 40 years in just the same way that treasury yields have been coming lower. That the answer to centrism and the ability of centrism to persist has been based on increasing the debt load. That the play along to get along mantra has been enabled because there has been a willingness to take on greater quantities of debt. And because we were in a disinflationary environment, which has been contributed to by the advances in technological innovation, as well as globalization, that contributed to the ability of these governments to continue to take on additional debt and keep the status quo intact. It was after 2008, when quantitative easing was introduced, that the true imbalance in the economies that had adopted this debt financing model has really been exposed, because quantitative easing has enriched the asset holders and it has been at the expense of savers. So that is one of the contributing factors behind the rise of what is variously called populism, xenophobia, racism, anti-immigrants, and then that's what are considered right-wing ways of thinking. Then you have Black Lives Matter, Me Too, and then you have the pro-immigration factors. You have the rise of communism, and that you have these old communist parties starting to gain attention again in Germany and in Sweden. So what these are reflections of is that once the center breaks, that the natural area for people to go is to the fringe. And it is to the fringes that people look for alternatives, because the center has been unable to provide an alternative. When we think back over the last few years, one of the most defining characteristics of the center has been that both left and right center parties offered very much the same set of policies, and that realistically the only difference was between the personality of the leaders and the historic voting aims of the vast majority of people. And that entire system is now breaking down. But it's breaking down in conjunction with Treasury yields coming back up towards the 3% level. I think it is also worth highlighting that this breakdown of the status quo and revolt against it is occurring during one of the most persistent bull markets on Wall Street in history. And it really does depend on how one wants to count how long this expansion has been, but there is absolutely no denying that the S&P 500 has rallied spectacularly in the last decade. And it is now at 2,871 points, and it bottomed at 666 in 2009. So now the question is whether we see any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics. Well, the only thing I think we can say is that it is somewhat overbought in the short term. But this rebound has been very powerful over the course of the last while. Then we also have the Russell 2000. And the Russell 2000 has been a clear outperformer over the course of the last 3 years in particular, because it is not particularly influenced by what's going on in the emerging markets, and it is more heavily influenced by the domestic demand growth story for the US, which is being boosted by the fiscal stimulus. It has outperformed. Well, it's also the index, therefore, to keep a close eye on for when it starts to underperform. Generally speaking, small caps are interest rate sensitive. So that's a potential headwind out there on the horizon. But the fiscal stimulus has been regarded as a sugar high. And eventually, sugar highs end, and then the person who has benefited from the sugar high feels rather sluggish. Well, the Russell 2000 has been down this week, but not in a particularly dynamic manner. We've had much larger dynamics back at the beginning of this year, but there's no denying that it is overbought in the short term, particularly relative to the trend mean, and the trend mean is now coinciding with the upper side of that underlying longer or bigger trading range. So I think that's one of the other points to to monitor in this market? Well, if we are in the latter stages of the bull market, then it's usually that you would expect cyclical sectors to do better. But so far, we haven't seen a great deal of that. We saw that, for example, the mining sector did substantially better in 2016 and all the way through until the middle of this year. But now, for example, the FTSE 350 mining index has dropped this week to break its progression of higher reaction lows. So this does not look like particularly bullish action. Well, we have to consider that mining is heavily reliant on what's going on in China. And we've looked at the Chinese market. It does not look strong. Therefore, commodity producers are at risk. The Australian index pulled back very violently in the last three sessions, and it is now right in the region of the trend mean. The Australian dollar has also been weakening for most of this year, and it was at a new reaction low in here today. I think that there is a risk here that the slowdown in China turns into something more. That is what the commodity complex is telling us. If we look at the copper price, it has so far failed to rally, and it's had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. There has been some attempt to steady, but there hasn't really been anything in the way of an upward dynamic, and this is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. If we look at what's going on in commodity complex, soybeans, for example, is right back on its lows. Now, it has bounced last week, and it was pretty much unchanged this week, but this is an important area. If we look at it over the very long term, then this is about where, if we're going to anticipate support coming back in, it's around this level. Prior to the bull market that we saw in agricultural commodities, it was the 500-point level that had offered support on multiple occasions over the previous bull market. Well, lumber prices had surged higher on the NAFTA, or the failure of the NAFTA negotiations, but now they're coming back down, and it was limit down again in here today, and it is now trading below 400. So this is looking like a fresh breakdown, and that the $400 level is not going to hold. So this is a further extension of the decline that we've seen. But these are, generally speaking, industrial resources. If we look at the LME Metals Index, which is comprised of the six primary industrial metals, then it continues to extend its decline. Then, if we look at, for example, what's going on in Canada, the stock market is now also right back in the region of its trend mean. Then, looking at it longer term, this is the region of the 16,000 area had been an area of resistance for years prior to this breakout. So now the question is whether it will be able to sustain this move. The Canadian dollar has continued to weaken. The time when it was trading stronger to the US dollar in 2011 and 12 feels like a distant memory, I'm sure. And the progression of higher reaction lows since the middle of 2017 remains very much intact. It does look like we're going to see a weaker loonie, a weaker Australian dollar, also a weaker Kiwi dollar, as long as these commodity prices remain under pressure. Well, what is really helping to stabilize the attitude towards commodities has been the relative strength of oil. If oil, on the other hand, fails at $80 and also moves into a downtrend, then that is what would get people anxious. A downtrend in oil would probably be interpreted as a lack of supply, considering that there is a lack of demand, because supply is relatively assured in the current environment. So when we look at what's going on in stock markets, if it the in the cyclical sector the commodities are not doing especially well, then within the technology sector, it is biotechnology. It tends to be rather cyclical, and it was up in a dynamic manner last week, and it gave up part of that advance in here this week. It was stable in here today, but it's going to have to bounce next week if the recovery scenario is going to be given the benefit of the doubt. Well, then I think it's, well, if it's not the industrial commodities, and the biotech sector does show promise, but it has to really demonstrate that it can hold this advance. Well, what about the agricultural sector? Because prices are really quite low, and the fertilizers and potash ETF has been holding a progression of higher reaction lows for nearly 3 years, but it was also down in negative territory in here today. So it does need to bounce from the $10 area if the upward bias is going to be sustained. There is the additional point when we think about inflation. Well, if commodity prices are under pressure, that's likely to keep a lid on inflationary pressures. But we do have to keep an eye on what are considered staple food items. So, for example, lean hogs have bounced from the lower side of their range. It's probably more correct to look at the at this stage at the second month continuation chart. And when we look at that, it's at new recovery highs. There is the possibility that with swine flu coming through in China, and in an increasing number of regions, that has the potential to foment inflation. Inflation, particularly when currencies are under pressure, is a rather difficult prospect, because countries have got a choice as to whether they are going to really moderate or increase their interest rates to try and moderate inflation, or whether the inflation is temporary or secular. When we look at the performance of countries that are both energy importers and have generally had higher inflation, I think it is notable that the Indian rupee has continued to decline. Then there is a big differentiator between the currencies where we have seen some pressure coming through and the standards of governance. There is an important election coming up in Brazil. The right-wing candidate, who I think it's fair to say that markets would favor, was stabbed in the stomach 2 days ago. So that may create a sympathy vote for him, and that did help to stabilize the real. But what we would need to see is a break in this downward bias, and certainly a sustained move above the trend mean. The countries where we have these big questions about governance are proliferating. And I think it is worth considering that this is following what has been a relatively modest rally in the dollar. For example, the South African rand was quite a bit weaker back in 2015 than it is today, and yet it is experiencing a lot more trouble. Well, that also tells us that even though people were worried about foreign currency denominated debt back in 2014 and 2015, that once their currency started to stabilize again, they just got straight back to issuing more. So now the quantity of debt has increased. Their sensitivity to the currency markets has therefore become more acute. And that is one of the primary reasons that we continue to see this stress on these emerging markets. Nonetheless, we have seen a lot of selling pressure in Argentina and Turkey, and 60% interest rates have helped to stabilize the Argentine peso, and the Turkish lira has also stabilized from above the 7 level. But the Russian ruble is breaking down, and this looks like a consistent trend. The dollar has broken out again, and a clear downward dynamic would be required to question potential that this isn't going to just continue lower for the ruble. What that says to me is that the stress that we've seen in the emerging markets is not over. That it's going to require some substantial dollar weakness to really demonstrate that the selling pressure has reached its limit. But it is creating really quite attractive buying opportunities once the currencies start to turn around. Foreign investors or globally oriented investors are accustomed to getting capital market and currency market appreciation. Capital is both global and mobile, so it will go to the regions that offer the best yield or the best potential for returns or for currency market returns. And those generally are in the emerging markets. So it is when we start to see these markets selling off aggressively that people start to get interested once more. But it really is down to what happens with the US dollar. And the dollar continues to look like it has room to improve from here. It was bouncing somewhat today from the region of the trend mean. Personally, I think that considering the risk that is outstanding in Europe and the fact that Europe is both exposed to what is going on in Italy and China, that it is rather hard to make a very bullish case for the euro. Well, that is also one of the factors that is pressuring the commodity complex. What this suggests is that this narrowing of breath in terms of a global market performance, the narrowing of breath within the USA, is and the evidence of markets starting to pick up pace on the upside with increasing evidence of acceleration, is that we are entering perhaps the final stages of the third psychological perception stage of this advance. I think it is one of the most important points is that the repatriation of profits that is helping to boost the buyback totals this year is not going to be repeated. The money can only be brought home once. And therefore, one has to ask what is going to be the big motivating factor behind advance or the continued advance in the stock market next year. Another way of thinking about that is when we look at multinational debt issuance, that they were issuing in the order of 70 or 80 billion dollars a year in 2015, 16, and 17, and this year they've issued none. So these 10 multinational companies had very substantial cash piles, and they have literally decided to take it all home. Well, that also means that this is a one-hit wonder that is really helping to stoke the stock market. With low unemployment and still reasonably low interest rates, the consumer is in a buoyant mood. We certainly see that in my wife's retail business online, this year is, I think, up about 35 to 40% on last year for really selling exactly the same things. One of the other things, I know that this is very anecdotal, but the number of Bentleys and Rolls Royces that I see on the street has increased considerably in the last few months. And that really does hang out as an example of conspicuous spending, where people really do feel very confident about their futures when you decide to start driving a Rolls Royce. So what I think that is representative of is that we are in the third psychological perception stage of this bull market. That it is being driven higher by the technology sector and the small cap sectors. And that's not just the case in the US. That when we look at the smaller cap sectors in Japan, then The second section has been the clear outperformer, but now the question is whether this 7,000 area is going to hold. Then when we look at the MDAX in Germany, it is right in the region of the trend mean. And again, the big question is whether this level is going to hold and whether the 25,000 level is going to hold. Then when we look at the UK, the AIM100 was one of the clearest beneficiaries of the Brexit decision, and it has paused around the 6,000 level, but there's no evidence there that demand growth has, or the demand growth story has really ended. So it is the AIM100 among all of the European small cap sectors that is doing best. And of course, you don't have the headwind from interest rates just yet. So if we start to think about the future, well, the longer term perspective is that the best time to buy is after a pullback. That chasing accelerations is something that it can be considered the bigger fool theory, that you really are hoping that somebody else is even more bullish than you are. And that can only be considered with a tight stop. The alternative would be to find something in the cyclical sector that has the potential to do better, but perhaps to think more about defensives. The consumer staples sector and the utility sector are probably more defensive than they are, I think, cyclical. And they are gaining attention in here. What is also interesting is that when we look at the tobacco sector, it has been pulling back rather sharply. But there are defensive characteristics with regard to cannabis. Cannabis is both high growth, but they are selling an addictive product. And that is, I think, one of the factors that has helped to drive the price higher in Canada, where we've seen the legalization really start to stoke interest. Well, they've also accelerated recently. There is the potential here that they're going to pull back. Well, the extent to which they pull back is going to be very telling. Then, when we look at the sector that has done best out of this advance over the last few years, cloud computing still remains reasonably consistent on the upside when we look at it on an ETF basis. If we were to see that pulling back below the trend mean, well, that would be, I think, a lead indicator for trouble in the wider stock market. But so far, it has not done that, and it has room in which to consolidate. What that, I think, says to me at least is that the breadth of this market is narrowing, but it is not over. That this is still a bull market, that the lead indicators for future recessions are not flashing red, and therefore, the benefit of the doubt can continue to be given to the upside to shares that are and instruments that are still trending consistently. When we think about what it is, where are we in the longer term? The Dow Gold Ratio is a great way of thinking about it, in my view, because we have approximately 36 years between the various peaks, and therefore, it's unlikely we're going to see a major peak. And when I think about that, I think about the kind of peak which would not be surmounted for a decade, probably until the early 2030s. And what that perhaps I think is the way of thinking about that more than anything else is that we have had a 10-year expansion and it is not over. And there is the potential that it will become the longest in history by any way of measuring it. But it will eventually be followed by a recession, and that recession will result in prices falling anything from 20 to 40%, and that will represent a very attractive entry opportunity. But there is no sign that that is about to occur imminently. If I were to think about where the risks are, I think the biggest risk today is China, and that Europe also represents a threat. If that then feeds back into the USA, well, that could create a more modest recessionary environment in the USA than the kinds of crashes that we've seen in 2008 and 2000. But I think if we do have a recession, then we can anticipate that there are going to be some drastic drawdowns in just about all assets, but most particularly those that have been heavily levered. And there are plenty of those. Well, when we think about what it is that could help to drive the market higher over the course of the next 15 to 17 years, well, technological innovation is not really impacted by the business cycle, and the pace of innovation is accelerating higher in the healthcare sector, particularly in immuno-oncology and gene editing. Eventually, we're going to have a solid-state battery, and they keep pushing back the date on that. It was supposed to be 2018, and now it's 2020 from Tesla. The Dyson company thinks that they probably have one and that they're building a factory to manufacture cars in the UK. Well, that's a game changer for the automotive sector. We've had a big bull market in oil, and there's plenty of it about right now. So that is also one of the factors in the deterioration of the emerging markets because of the volatility in the commodity prices. Well, we also have this revolt against the status quo, and I think that can be boiled down to the simple question, "What about me?" And the answer that people generally get when they say, "What about me?" is here. Let me make it a little easier for you. And that a drive to pad out incomes with fiscal stimulus or more. I think what we're going to say, social subsidies, then that's directly inflationary. There is the potential that if we're thinking about the stock market going substantially higher over the next 17 years, that a good part of that will be inflationary. Generally speaking, when we've seen currencies doing worse, then that tends to inflate the asset price in nominal terms. So we're going to have both nominal price appreciation and also the potential for productivity growth. The potential for productivity growth is something that is almost a requirement for a big bull market to take hold. Personally, I think that one of the biggest threats to the status quo is that there will be a much wider revolt against globalization. That globalization could, or anti-globalization trend could contribute to much greater automation, particularly in the Western economies. And that's something that could be transformative for their domestic growth stories. So there is a lot to play for, and we are probably only halfway through this secular expanse and expansion, and eventually this first half will give way to a recession, and that will be a really very attractive buying opportunity. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.